Good morning, and thank you for coming. I have no relationships to disclose. The 2009 pandemic A, influenza A, H1N1, or PH1N1 virus, also referred to as swine flu, was first detected in humans in April 2009. In June of 2009, the World Health Organization declared the PH1N1 pandemic. Since April of 2009, CDC estimates over 60 million PH1N1 cases and over 12,000 PH1N1-related deaths in the United States. In the U.S., more than 13 million people are employed in healthcare settings, representing 9% of the entire U.S. workforce. Seasonal influenza has been shown to spread rapidly among patients and healthcare personnel, or HCP, in healthcare settings, and healthcare personnel are among the occupational groups considered at highest risk for exposure to pandemic influenza virus. Healthcare personnel nationwide have acquired healthcare-associated PH1N1 infections. Healthcare personnel use of personal protective equipment, or PPE, is especially important in a comprehensive influenza infection control strategy when vaccination is unavailable. In August of 2009, CDC NIOSH received a health hazard evaluation, or HHE, request from an internal medicine residency director in Utah concerning the exposure of internal medicine residents to PH1N1 virus. Several residents were reportedly diagnosed with PH1N1, an influenza-like illness, or ILI, in June of 2009. The overall HHE objectives were to estimate the prevalence of PH1N1 infection and ILI, identify modes of transmission, and assess knowledge, attitudes, and practices towards influenza infection control measures among this group of physicians. For this presentation, I'm just going to focus on one portion of this HHE. Our objectives for this sub-study were to determine adherence to PPE use among residents and fellows during the early PH1N1 pandemic, and also identify factors associated with high and low adherence. We used a cross-sectional study design. We reviewed training program records and hospital infection control policies. We invited 210 current and recently graduated internal medicine residents and cardiology and pulmonary and critical care fellows to participate in an electronic survey. We sent the electronic surveys in August and September of 2009. They consisted of questions regarding personal characteristics, work history, history of exposure to PH1N1 and ILI, ILI symptoms, and knowledge, attitudes, and practices regarding influenza infection control measures. We analyzed survey responses to 4-point frequency scale questions on use of PPE components when in close contact with patients with PH1N1 or ILI. Using these and hospital PPE recommendations, we categorized respondents into low and high PPE adherence groups. Low adherence was assigned to those respondents answering never or some of the time to any required component. High adherence was assigned to those respondents answering most of the time or always to all required components. We also accepted responses of using a higher level of protection than was recommended, such as using an N95 respirator when only a surgical mask was required. And we also accepted responses of using a PAPR, or powered air purifying respirator, without specific eye protection for assignment into the high adherence category. We then determined factors associated with high and low PPE adherence through bivariate analyses. 42% of the 210 residents and fellows completed the survey. Of those, 60% reported close contact with a PH1N1 or ILI patient and provided PPE adherence information. Residents and fellows rotate through 4 different hospitals on a biweekly or monthly basis. This table shows the minimum PPE requirements of each of the 4 hospitals as of September 2009. It is important to note that initially, all 4 hospitals followed CDC interim guidance for PPE use by healthcare personnel when caring for PH1N1 patients. However, due to logistical issues, 3 hospitals, A, C, and D, deviated from this guidance during June 2009. Hospital A required its healthcare personnel to wear gloves, a surgical mask, and eye protection when caring for flu patients. Hospital B required its healthcare personnel to wear gloves, gowns, either an N95 respirator or PAPR, and eye protection. Hospital C required its healthcare personnel to wear gloves and a surgical mask. And finally, Hospital D required its healthcare personnel to wear gloves, a gown, a surgical mask, and eye protection. Note that Hospital B was the only hospital that maintained the same minimum PPE requirements as recommended by CDC at the time. Also note that all hospitals recommended use of gloves, gowns, either a fit-tested N95 or PAPR, and eye protection during presence at any aerosol-generating procedures. This photo shows an example of PPE use that complies with this requirement. Using survey responses and hospital policies, 36% of respondents were classified as having high PPE adherence, while 64% were classified as having low PPE adherence. This table shows the most common reasons cited by respondents for not using recommended PPE. The most common reasons were, I did not know the patient had PH1N1 or ILI, and the recommended PPE was not available near my patient's rooms. The next most common reasons were, I did not think I needed it for the activity I was performing, and the facility ran out of the recommended PPE. In our bivariate analysis, the following were not associated with high or low PPE adherence: demographics, rotation location, agreement with infection control attitude statements, and knowledge of correct recommended PPE components. Factors that were associated with high PPE adherence included performance of or presence at an aerosol-generating procedure on a PH1N1 patient and rotation in the ICU. The factor that was associated with low PPE adherence was rotation on the general inpatient medicine wards. 28% of total respondents reported performance of or presence at an aerosol-generating procedure. When stratified by this variable, 21% of those who were not present at an aerosol-generating procedure were classified as having high adherence. Since we did not differentiate aerosol-generating procedures from other close contact when asking about use of all recommended PPE components, we were unable to ascertain adherence to all of the minimum PPE components recommended for these procedures. However, of the 24 who reported being present at or performing an aerosol-generating procedure, 12 reported always wearing appropriate respiratory protection, 7 reported wearing it most of the time, 1 reported wearing it some of the time, and 3 reported never wearing it. In conclusion, most ILI or PH1N1 patient-exposed responding physicians were classified as having low adherence to PPE use. The most common reasons cited for not using recommended PPE were lack of awareness of a patient having PH1N1 or ILI and reporting that PPE was unavailable near patient rooms. Our findings suggest that PPE use is appropriately emphasized in the ICU and during aerosol-generating procedures to high exposure situations. However, there is still room for improvement in these two areas. Our findings also suggest a lack of emphasis on PPE use when caring for non-critically ill PH1N1 or ILI patients. Our evaluation was subject to some limitations. First, though the period of highest absenteeism was in June of 2009, we did not actually receive the HHE request until August. Thus, respondents' ability to recall may have affected some of our results. Second, our classification of adherence to PPE use was based on self-reported behaviors by respondents. It has been shown in other studies that self-reported rates of PPE use tend to be higher when compared to observed rates. Therefore, our findings that 36% of respondents fit into the high adherence category may actually be an overestimation. Third, our response rate was 42% and our sample size was 88. Thus, our results may not be generalizable to all physicians in these programs and to healthcare personnel in general. Based on our findings, we made the following recommendations to the training program and its hospitals. First, provide education and training to residents and fellows on recommended PPE and proper use. Second, improve timely placement of signage that indicates appropriate isolation precautions. Third, make PPE more readily available near patient rooms. Fourth, emphasize PPE use when caring for non-critically ill influenza patients. I'd like to thank my NIOSH, CDC NIOSH co-authors and supervisors, as well as the residents, fellows, and faculty at the University of Utah. I'll be happy to answer questions at this time. Yes.
I was struck by how different the policies were between four hospitals. Somewhat indicates differences in management commitment towards health and safety. And I was wondering if it ever dawned up, or if the questions ever raised to try to look at the perception of the residents in terms of what management is communicating down to them in terms of expectations for performing.
Yeah, as part of this HHE, we attended noon conferences at each of the four hospitals. We had a chance to meet with the residents and fellows. And, you know, one of the big themes of those meetings were that they rotate through three or four hospitals throughout their residency, and they were just confused by all of the different PPE recommendations. I will say that initially all four hospitals did follow CDC guidance that came out, but due to really logistical issues, three of those hospitals deviated from that guidance. The one that did continue to follow CDC guidance was a Veterans Affairs hospital. As part of the HHE, we also met with hospital administrators, hospital epidemiologists, employee health people, and other key management people. And really, the downgrade in the recommendations was just driven by pure logistics. They were reporting running out of N95 respirators. Also, Salt Lake City is a low-incidence TB area, so not all of employees were participating in a respiratory protection program. So they were having to quickly fit test and train all employees as part of this response to the pandemic. So we did also look at that during this HHE. Yes?
I know there's been some discussion about which type of mask to recommend. Did you find any evidence whether it mattered whether it's N95 or
any kind of mask? Three of the four hospitals were recommending a surgical mask, and we found that less than half of the respondents actually adhered to even a surgical mask, much less an N95 respirator. There was a component of our HHE where we looked at the illness cases. We had 13 cases of influenza-like illness among this group of residents, and we did not find that their use of PPE mattered, largely because not all of their exposures were patient-related. Two of the cases had exposures to other sick physicians that came to work, and another two physicians had exposures to two sick physicians outside of work. So it wasn't, in our evaluation, it wasn't always a patient to healthcare worker transmission.
That's a good question. I wondered if you looked at, in a separate part of this agency, vaccination status, and whether vaccination status affected the use of PPE, giving, I think we've heard that there's potentially the false sense that they're completely covered,
right,
and therefore don't need to use PPE.
Yeah, our survey came out in August of September, so the PH1N1 vaccine was not available yet. We did look at seasonal vaccination rates for the previous year, and over 90% of respondents had that, but we did not look at PPE adherence comparing if it was associated to seasonal vaccine, but it would be something to look at. Yes?
Could you go on a little more explanation about the logistical problems, because it is not a large group here, right? And the amount of fit testing and the availability of equipment hardly seems logistical, rather seems that the hospital wasn't interested in providing the equipment for.
Well, keep in mind that these are just residents that we looked at. They're just a minority of employees in a big medical center, which also include pretty much everyone else. Pretty much the logistical concerns that were conveyed to us were that they were running out of N95 respirators. They were mysteriously, a bunch of respirators had mysteriously vanished. They would fit test employees for one type of respirator, such as, or I'm not going to mention any types, and then run out of those. And then a lot of the N95 manufacturers were backed up and not meeting their demand. And hospitals were having to order different types of N95 respirators, but these necessarily weren't the ones, the type that the employees were fit tested the first go around. So there were issues like that. Right. I think it did. We did our survey, even though it was deployed in August, our specific period of interest was May and June. So we were asking about PPE use during their the period where they had the most infections.
And you didn't observe that? You didn't do any observations?
We didn't do any direct observations.